Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, we have like 5 tickets left now for our Friday show in the Green Space, 10 a.m. So if you want to come in and hear from all kinds of people from all over the world on what happens after a revolution, drawing on experiences from Iran to Cuba to the Philippines to South Africa to everywhere, get your tickets at thegreenspace.org. But there's just a handful left for Friday morning show, $10 tickets. Meanwhile, the revolution will be tweeted. By now, you've heard about the Egyptian Google executive and democracy advocate, Wael Ghanim, who helped start the demonstrations with an anonymous Facebook post, then was secretly detained by Egyptian police, who figured out who he was. Now released from detention, Ghanim went on a popular Egyptian talk show Monday night and became a public icon literally overnight for the movement as he reacted emotionally to what had unfolded while he was in captivity. 16 seconds through a translator as provided by The Takeaway.
First of all, I send my condolences to all the people who were killed. It was a peaceful revolution. We didn't want to do any damage. Don't focus your cameras on me. I'm not a hero. The real heroes are the youth who are behind this revolution.
A Google exec who helped launch the revolution without even attaching his name to a Facebook post. My next guest almost predicted it. Joseph Nye is already perhaps the world's leading authority on political power in world affairs. He's been a State Department or Pentagon official for Carter, Clinton, and H.W. Bush. He's been dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he wrote the highly influential 2004 book, Soft Power, arguing that a hearts and minds approach to power was as needed as the military kind in the post-9/11 world. Everyone uses the term soft power now. And now he's written a new book built around what he calls smart power for the digital social media age. This book is called The Future of Power. Joseph Nye, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Nice to be with you.
Your book was completed before the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, obviously, but are you seeing it come to life before your eyes?
Yeah, it's what we're seeing in Tunisia and Egypt is very much consistent with what the theme of the book is that the information revolution is changing the way we need to think about power. I mean, traditionally, we'd say power was the one with the biggest army, whose army wins. In the information age, it's not just whose army wins, it's whose story wins. Narrative is much more important, and that's what you're seeing in the Middle East today.
Whose story wins? That's pretty romantic for a hard-bitten foreign policy hand like you.
It's true, and one of the problems is Americans tend to have a sort of a mechanistic or mechanical view of power, that it's can you beat down the other guy, the cowboy, the gunslinger view. We forget that there's another part of the American tradition which goes back to John Winthrop, the shining city on the hill. And we often attract people. And if we forget that that's a large part of power and becoming more important in an information age, we're missing an important dimension.
So arguably, we have a weak story in Egypt right now because one thing that seems to be sparking the revolution or that has held people down in a state of repression that eventually led to the revolution is that the U.S. backed dictators like Mubarak in Egypt and Ben Ali in Tunisia and the non-democratic regimes in Saudi Arabia, Arabia and elsewhere around there because we got things from them. So do you see that paradigm breaking down? Do you see that story as now hurting the United States as things change?
Well, I think we will suffer from our past behavior. But we used to have a view that the Middle East was either dictators or Islamists and that you had nothing in between. And what the information revolution has done is provided more information to more people than any time before in history. And in addition, added things like Twitter, Facebook, text messaging, which allows them to coordinate. That's a different world. And that means there's a middle in between the dictator and the Islamists. And we've got to learn to work with that middle.
How do you see the U.S. using what remains of its power in Egypt, in the current situation? They're coming under criticism, the Obama administration is, for backing the vice president, Suleiman, from the Mubarak regime for leading the transition to democracy with other insiders. Here's Secretary of State Clinton on Sunday.
There are forces at work in any society, and particularly one that is facing these kinds of challenges, that will try to derail or overtake the process to pursue their own specific agenda.
So what's your reaction to that cautious approach, insider approach even now, from a smart power standpoint?
Well, I heard Hillary give that speech at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend. She's got a point. We have to work with governments, and the last thing we want is for a revolution in which we have a Kerensky who's then overthrown by Bolsheviks after him. You have to work with governments, but you at the same time have to appeal to the larger civil society. That balancing act is difficult. What she is saying, I think what the administration is trying to do, is we want to keep a constant effort to move forward, but trying to do it overnight is not going to work. The problem is, how do you get that balance right? It's a tightrope, and it's a rough one.
At the risk of squandering U.S. legitimacy for the new, hopefully democratic Egypt.
Yeah, and that's the danger, which is if you suddenly had Mubarak overthrown and chaos, the army would step in. What we have to make sure of is even when we get rid of Mubarak, that we don't wind up with Mubarakism without Mubarak. We want something more than just an army control.
And President Obama's envoy to Mubarak, Bernard Wisner, went even further over the weekend. This was astonishing. Listen to me.
The president in particular needs to provide the leadership that would take the changes that would permit an orderly transition to his parliament and lead Egypt through this path. So President Mubarak's role remains utterly critical in the days ahead.
So as a former State Department Deputy Undersecretary, what was that about? Was he off the reservation, or is that part of a collection of messages that the U.S. is sending out?
No, I think what Frank Wisner was trying to say is that we want an orderly process, but it doesn't have to be Mubarak. Mubarak could, in fact, delegate his power, as he's done in the past when he's been ill. What we need to do is to see the Constitution changed, see the emergency law repealed, and lay the groundwork for real democratic elections in the future. It doesn't have to be Mubarak who does it, but just overthrowing Mubarak isn't enough.
And I got his first name wrong. It is, as you said, Frank Wisner. Let me ask you a question about the underlying assumption in all of this, that the U.S. should strive to be the global leader, should strive for power in international affairs, especially in the post-Cold War era. Ungenerously, the main reason for all of this quest for superpower status is to hoard the world's wealth. As you note in the book, we have 5% of the population, but 25% of total wealth, and we consume 25% of the oil with 5% of the population. Is there a more generous reason for the U.S. being a superpower in today's world than hoarding as much of the world's wealth as we can?
Well, power is not good or bad per se. It's sort of like calories in your diet. Too much can be bad for you, and that perhaps is what happened to us in the early part of this century when we invaded Iraq. So overdoing this power and hegemony is a mistake. On the other hand, somebody has to help organize networks, institutions, coalitions to deal with real challenges like climate change, like financial stability, like dealing with terrorism or stopping nuclear proliferation. To that extent, the United States is the best placed of any country to do this. If the largest country doesn't help to organize management of those public goods or challenges, nobody else can do it. So that's a reason why American power can be beneficial, even though it's not beneficial some of the time. Sometimes we misuse it.
But if we're trying to maintain this outsized standard of consumption, no wonder we back the Saudi and Egyptian dictators, either for oil or stability, to put down Islamists. And no wonder that results in radicalizing some people against us who then go on to stage terrorist attacks. Not to oversimplify, mm-hmm. but is that not a large truth?
Well, there are a lot of things that we have to do in terms of reducing imported oil, becoming more energy efficient. There are things that we can do to make things better. But it's worth noticing that on, for example, climate change, we're not the superpower anymore. China produces more CO2 each year than we do. It's going to take working with others to try to deal with these things. Instead of just thinking of power over others, we also need to think of power with others, the ability to work with others to get things done.
What do you think of WikiLeaks in your smart power context, a force for transparency or a force for destruction?
Well, I think WikiLeaks, we've placed too much emphasis on Julian Assange. If he'd never been born, it would have happened anyway. That's in the nature of this information revolution that I describe in the
book.
It was
the fact that the Pentagon employee, if it was all this one guy, was able to get all these documents on his computer, and whether he shipped them to Julian Assange or whether he shipped them to the New York Times, the story is really that.
Yeah, and somebody else would have done it if not Julian Assange. I think the lesson of this is we don't want to prosecute Assange and damage our own freedom of the press. That's shooting ourselves in the foot. We do want to manage our own databases better. We need to classify less information and then set up databases where we monitor the truly secret information much more effectively than what you do.
The other main idea in your book, and we just have about a minute left, is that power won't shift to other countries like China simply, but become more distributed. And I wonder if you think that's a dangerous thing. I remember during the run-up to the Iraq War, the president of France at the time, in opposing the war, suggested a more multipolar world without the U.S. as the sole superpower. And people went crazy over that, warning that diffuse power would mean international chaos and weakness and therefore more chances for bad actors like Iran to gain power.
Well, what I argue in the book is that there are two great power shifts going on. What you might call the rise of the rest in terms of other states, but also the shift of power from governments to non-governmental actors, which is best illustrated by cyber power. We're going to have to learn to deal with both those at the same time.
WikiLeaks is an example of that?
WikiLeaks is an example, but so also are our Twitter, Facebook, and all the new mechanisms that are distributing power.
15 seconds. As a former dean of the Kennedy School, how do you feel about some professors of diplomacy refusing to study the WikiLeaks cables with their students, either out of moral objection or fear that they'll be blacklisted?
That's what they used to call Luddism, which is a negative reaction to technology.
Joseph Nye, his new book, is The Future of Power. Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.